2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 371, Violence on the Mormon Frontier, Fact or Fiction. Panelists Will Bagley, Edward Leo Lyman, D. Michael Quinn, William Shepherd, and Polly Aird.
I think we're going to have a very interesting discussion on some significant issues. In the winter of 1851, according to the Oregon and California immigrants who had been by circumstances compelled to spend the winter in Salt Lake settlements, a very interesting incident occurred at the Jordan River Bridge, which is right where North Temple crosses Jordan River. A group of guards had allegedly been sent there by Brigham Young to lay in ambush for a gentleman named Turner. Turner had contracted with Brigham Young to put roads up a canyon, almost certainly City Creek, which was Brigham Young's personal property. Brigham Young owed Turner a great deal of money, and according to the Gentiles, these guards were sent to the river bridge to assassinate Turner. It was growing dark in the evening. A single rider approached. The guards leaped up. The rider saw the men, reined in his horse, tried to turn around, and was immediately shot out of the saddle. The assassins then ran up to see, make sure Turner was gone, and to their horror, found that they had shot Lorenzo Dow Young, the brother of Brigham Young. Now, this interesting incident might be used to support my theory that the most dangerous place in Utah Territory was between Brigham Young and a nickel, but it does have another interesting aspect. I would suspect that faithful historians, I'll say BYU historians, would argue that you cannot prove that Brigham Young ordered his brother shot out of the saddle. Well, we wouldn't attempt to prove that. But the question is, why was there no public investigation? Why, if the authorities had not sanctioned this, did not the governor of the territory, in outrage, track down the men who had shot his beloved brother off his horse? I think that, personally, supports the contention that there was what later colorful writers would call holy murder practiced in Utah. Unfortunately, we have a very, well, we not unfortunately, we have a very distinguished panel. But unfortunately, it has fallen to my lot to defend the faithful position. And I will... I will do my best to represent it, and I will try to ask the hard questions to keep everybody on track. And I'm going to offer brief introductions. Leo Lyman is a professor of history, I think at several places in California. He is noted in California as one of the leading experts on Mormonism. He's an excellent trail historian, and he's just put together a very good book on a subject that's almost ignored in Western history, which is the Salt Lake Los Angeles Road. It's called an arduous road. I think they've got them for sale here. Plus, he's bringing out what I think will be a true trail classic from the city. From the City of the Angels to the City of the Saints, unless I've got it backwards.
You got it backwards.
And it is a history of that very important overland immigrant and freighting road. Bill Shepherd comes to us from one of the most interesting branches of the Restoration, the followers of James Strang. Bill lives in what used to be known as Borah, Wisconsin. He's the trustee for some of the Strangite properties there, and he is a thoroughly remarkable researcher. I've had the pleasure of meeting Bill at several conferences, and the depth of his research, I believe, surprises everybody. And it's not just his ability to go out and dig up materials, but I think it's his even-handed approach to this material. And he's addressed very difficult questions, such as the charges that the 12 orchestrated the murder of Samuel Smith in the summer of 1845. Very controversial questions. The evidence is very contradictory, but I've seen Bill handle these kinds of subjects in a very good way. Michael Quinn, I could certainly say, needs no introduction. He is often, by historians of my generation, recognized as the premier historian of Mormonism in his age group. It's not a very elegant way to say it. What I mean to say is Michael is recognized as the preeminent scholar of Mormonism in his generation. It's now my pleasure to introduce Polly Aird, who is not a Mormon, and comes from, however, a family with a very interesting Mormon history. And I'm always delighted in conferences like this when we can interact with people who haven't been raised with the same culture, and sometimes the cultural biases that we have. And I believe that the perspectives of those outside of Mormon culture on our history can be exceptionally useful. And Polly is a very, very insightful analyst, but she's also a very, very diligent researcher. She's working on a biography of her Mormon ancestor. Is it Peter McCollum?
Peter
McCausland. Who was a Scots immigrant to Springville, Spanish Fork in the 1850s, and was one of the immigrants who left Utah under escort of the army following the Utah War. Polly was the manager of technical communications for the Boeing Company. She's a graduate of Stanford. I anticipate that we'll see a fascinating look at a little examined, seldom examined aspect of Mormon history from my friend Polly. But to the subject. The American West was a violent and dangerous place. Visitors to Utah Territory often commented on the order and quiet disport of the Mormon settlements, even as they described the dictatorial theocracy that ruled the area. Fueled by the public statements of Utah's Mormon leaders, violence in Utah was soon a subject of national debate. By the 1870s, most Americans believed that Mormonism's frontier leaders sanctioned religious violence and a form of religious terrorism. Much of this, such as tales of avenging angels and Danites, was myth. But other incidents, notably the Mountain Meadows Massacre, support the image of theocratic holy murder, as Charles Kelly dubbed it sometime later. And these events are supported by stubborn historical facts, as B.H. Roberts characterized them. Defenders of the faith today, however, argue that Utah's violence was part of the violence endemic on the western frontier, and that crimes were often unjustly laid at the church's door. They insist it is impossible to connect Mormon leaders with a policy of holy murder. One of the official statements that we now have in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism is by Lowell M. Snow on the confusing subject of blood atonement. Snow wrote, "Several church leaders, notably Brigham Young, taught that in a complete theocracy, the Lord could require the voluntary shedding of a murderer's blood, presumably by capital punishment, as part of the process of atonement for such grievous sin." This was referred to as blood atonement. "Since such a theocracy has not been operative in modern times, the practical effect of the idea was its use as a rhetorical device to heighten the awareness of the Latter-day Saints of the seriousness of murder and other major sins. This view was not a doctrine of the church and has never been practiced by the church at any time." Early anti-Mormon writers charged that under Brigham Young, the church practiced blood atonement, by which they meant church-instigated violence directed at dissenters, enemies, and strangers. This claim distorted the whole idea of blood atonement, which was based on voluntary submission by an offender, into a supposed justification of involuntary punishment. Occasional isolated acts of violence that occurred in some areas where Latter-day Saints lived were typical of that period in the history of the American West, but they were not instances of church-sanctioned blood atonement. I've got a quote from Bruce R. McConkie, if anybody would like to hear it. But the end of it is, dishonest persons have attempted to make it appear that Brigham Young and others taught things just the opposite of what they really believed and taught. McConkie's essay on blood atonement in the first edition of Mormon Doctrine is quite entertaining, because he begins by strenuously denying that there was ever such a thing, and then he explains what it is and how it will be practiced when we do have the perfect theocracy. Professional Mormons historians have also examined these questions. Rebecca Foster Cornwell and Leonard J. Arrington, in an essay called The Perpetuation of a Myth, Mormon Danites in Five Western Novels, said, incidents of violence on the Utah frontier were rare considering the expanse of the Mormon settlements and almost immediate interruption of its isolation. Surrounding the most tragic and widely reported incident, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, was an inflammatory circumstance. Utah was in a state of war, preparing for an invasion. Unfortunately, the details of the massacre were usually distorted in the national press. I'm afraid, though, if you look at the accounts in the national press, they are much more accurate than anything that has to this day appeared in the pages of the Deseret News. Cornwell and Arrington further argue that Joseph Smith and later Brigham Young constantly found it necessary to instill some grace into members who were overeager for revenge. It can be safely said that although church authorities occasionally let off steam in public, in action they were unusually restrained, counseling non-provocation. Contradicting these defenses, historian Winnie DeBrooks concluded blood atonement was a literal and terrible reality. Brigham Young advocated and preached it without compromise. Commenting on a particularly vicious form of frontier violence, Brooks wrote, if it were necessary to emasculate a man who was corrupting the morals of the community, it would serve as a warning to others that such things would not be tolerated. Such castrations are a matter of the historic record in Utah Territory. Juanita Brooks also noted that her own LDS Temple Endowment blessing was to avenge the blood of the prophet, a reference to the murders of Hiram and Joseph Smith. As Wallace Stegner wrote, it would be bad history to pretend that there were no holy murders in Utah and along the trails to California, that there was no saving of the souls of sinners by the shedding of their blood during the Blood Atonement Revival of 1856, that there were no mysterious disappearances of apostates and offensive Gentiles. So, the question before the panel is, what was the actual level of religious violence in Utah? And are histories that attribute the origins of this violence to Mormon beliefs and leaders bad history? I think we'll start and just start from Leo and work this way.
Well, why don't you go over the format? How much time do you want us to do on the original?
Well, why don't you, we've got an hour and a half. Why don't you take 10, 15 minutes?
We don't have an hour and a half now, though.
No. What do we have left?
About an hour and 15.
Well, if you do 10 minutes, that's...
First start.
That's a start.
Okay.
And then we do hope to open it up to questions. And I am especially disappointed that we couldn't get someone who would have come up and vigorously defended the traditional church's position on this. But I will try to fill in the gap.
I'm not going to. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be on the panel with Mike Quinn, who probably did the best work on the culture of violence, which many members of the church have never heard of. We were not taught that kind of doctrine in our church in our day, but our great-grandfathers were. In about 1853, during the Waukara War, there were decrees that said nobody will leave this territory. And those who tried were threatened. It was martial law kinds of things. Not long after that, they opened the Southern Indian Mission in harmony between Cedar City and what would be St. George. And in the second week that the missionaries were down there, mostly northern Utah brethren, in their own church service, they talked about one of their purposes. They don't say that this is an assignment that came from the general authorities, but their purpose is to get close enough to the Native American Paiutes that they can use them as a battle axe for the Lord. That is a term that's used. You ought to look at Juanita Brooks's edition of Thomas Brown's History of the Southern Indian Mission. The documentation of the success in bringing those people into an alliance to be used to exact vengeance against enemies from Missouri and Illinois particularly is just amazingly clear, including the statements. In 1857, the crucial year, because it's the year of Mountain Meadows, early in that year, three non-Mormons and John Tobin, who had come to Utah with the army, had courted one of Brigham's daughters, been rejected by her even though he had been on some mission, and married Charles C. Rich's daughter instead, was allegedly escaping from Mormondom. And he and three associates, including a Colonel Peltrow, who had been a surveyor in Utah, were attacked in the night at a place that's still known as Tobin Point. I believe Bagley could tell you where Tobin Point was, down by Gunlock. They had a lot of baggage around their sleeping area, and they were just riddled with bullets, but none of them were killed. Three of them were wounded. The next morning, Peltrow did some investigating and saw shod horses and footprints of people that were not wearing moccasins. And that was played up big time in the Los Angeles newspapers and later in the New York Times. But it was done in conjunction with another episode in Springville involving William, what's his last name, Rel? Parrish. And his sons Beatsum and Oren. Rel Francis is from Springville. He knows this situation very, very well. William Parrish has come to Springville, has consecrated his property to the church, and now is trying to get it back. He had wanted to go to Los Angeles 2 years earlier and had been stopped, as had his brother Ezra, who eventually got down there, and so did a nephew named Enoch Parrish. But when William and Beatson tried it in the night, they were killed. And Oren was only not killed because Potter, who was in on the assassination, was forced to march third in line instead of fourth, and they killed the guy that was third in line also. That was labeled in the newspapers outside of Utah another murder on this Mormon trail to California. People trying to escape from Utah. And, in fact, some of the Parrish family say William was just trying to get to Salt Lake to appeal for justice to Brigham Young when he was killed. And I don't know whether that's true or not. All I know is that I have seen in the church historian's office an unsigned letter from the First Presidency's office that spring to the Bishop of Springville, Aaron Johnson, isn't it? And there's one to Bishop Brunson in Fillmore, one to William Dame in Parowan, that say, we're sorry that a couple guys who have been apprehended and put in jail are still alive and still free. It doesn't exactly say that, but that's the meaning. And they're assigning these church leaders to watch these people as they leave and make sure they don't steal any horses. And if they do, they don't want any trials this time. Now, what does that mean to you? I know what it means to me. Now, that isn't a smoking gun, but it's about as close as you can come. Then there's the very controversial, at least when Bagley's book comes out, smoking gun involving on September 1st, 1857, in Brigham Young's office, meeting with the leading Indian chiefs of southern Utah, in which Dimmick Huntington, who speaks their language but is very close to Brigham Young, and Brigham Young's in the room, they're told, you can have the cattle of the immigrants now in southern Utah, and that doesn't just include the Fanchers. That includes at least three other groups. And those groups aren't going to give up their cattle without a fight. It's almost a death sentence. I don't think anybody intended it to get so far out of hand as it does. I've tried to say that you can't understand the violence in Kosovo unless you have grown up in that culture where even the nursery rhymes and the children's stories and the popular songs talk about how mean Muslims were to your forefathers. But we had that same thing in the church in the early days in Illinois and Missouri, and Quinn's work is the best on this stuff. But he also says not everybody believes it. I'm presently working on the biography of my great-great-grandfather, who was a heretic. He ended up outside the church, even though he had been almost in the First Presidency with Joseph Smith and had been an apostle and a missionary most of his adult life. 4 months after Mountain Meadows, Amos Lyman is in Cedar City at a meeting he calls. And this is what he says to the brethren, and this is in John D. Lee's diary of all places. He says that Amos had delivered an address at a special meeting he called in Cedar City, in which he elaborated at some length on the subject of encouraging Native Americans in the region to retaliate and exact revenge. I don't think he was the only one that believed that, but my gosh, I think it's stupid for him to go to a place where they've sworn themselves to revenge against anybody that even talks about this and say, don't preach this to the Indians anymore. And it wasn't just a one-time thing. The next year he preaches at least three sermons in Dixie saying the same thing, and in one of those Lee says, Elder Lyman addressed the saints on the subject of avenging the blood of the prophets, which he said never would be done by butchering each other, but to the contrary, by implanting in the mind and cultivating the opposite principle until man cease to sin and be as one family, etc. That's the Christian view, but it's not necessarily the view that the brethren have been teaching for 10 years. And we've totally lost that sense of it until Quinn's second volume came out. And I don't know whether it's even possible. I say that it isn't, as a history teacher, to get people to empathize. Can we really understand how desperate people were in the Depression? How insecure people were in the Depression? I don't think so. I don't think we can understand how elated somebody would be to hear somebody been killed who happens to be from Missouri, even if they're from Arkansas. I think I've given it my 10 minutes. It's somebody else's turn.
Going to speak very briefly about Nauvoo. There were criminal gangs at Nauvoo from the settlement through the expulsion. There was the Hodge gang, which I related to in the last session. There were also other gangs that were within the church, some of them cut off. But Michael Riggs had done a study of some of the people that were cut off from the Ramos branch that circulated around and came right back, re-entered the Nauvoo society. So there was an ongoing problem with Mormon criminals. 23 June 1844, Irving Hodge is murdered right outside Brigham Young's door, within a yard or so, no doubt in my mind, murdered by the Nauvoo police. There are other instances of violence. There are possible violence. Samuel Harrison Smith, the surviving brother, other than dear William, Samuel dies rather mysteriously. Michael Quinn pointed out in Origins that William Smith became suspicious and found out, came to the conclusion later, that he was poisoned by perhaps the Nauvoo captain of police, Hosea Stout, who had been feeding him a white powder. Mary B. Smith Norman, Samuel's daughter, related in old age that Hosea Stout was nursing her father with a white powder. I found in James J. Strang's Gospel Herald of November 1849, the statement in an article, Martyrs of the Latter-day Saints, it added, Samuel H. Smith, brother of Joseph and Hiram Smith, who died from the effects of poison administered to him within one month after the martyrdom of his brothers. From Hosea Stout's diary of 4 November 1844, Hosea writes, and his, Joseph Smith's, blood is now seen to be on the floor of the jail at Carthage, where it cries for vengeance to God for vengeance on this nation who rejoiced at his fall. This mindset and mentioning atoning for the blood of the prophets was very prevalent. 25 January 1845, William Clayton records for Heber Kimball. Elder Kimball showed the right fashion for a leaf spoke of by Elder Richards being protected at Carthage Jail, having on his robe, while Joseph and Hiram and Elder Taylor were shot to pieces, said that the 12 would have to leave shortly for a charge of treason would be brought against them for swearing us to avenge the blood of the anointed ones, and some would reveal it, and we shall have to part, some say, between sundown and dark. He also said, There are from 7 to 12 persons who have met together every day to pray since Joseph's death, and his people have been sustained upon this principle. And I have covenanted and never will rest, nor my posterity after me, until those men who killed Joseph and Hiram have been wiped out from the earth. The Nauvoo captain of police, Hosea Stout, tells about going to the temple, or going in the morning and finding that the police had almost beat a man to death. And he said, I was glad of it. People protested. He went to Brigham Young, and Brigham Young said, good. He said, keep the police on the case. Giving a man like Hosea Stout the power over life and death could be frightening. Hosea Stout's diary entry of 13 March 1847. At dark, I went to a meeting of the 70s at the council house. Here, J.P. Packer was brought up before them for a charge of stealing a brace of six-shooters by getting them with a forged order. Some was for cutting him off, some for keeping him on trial a while, and so on. I spoke quite lengthy on the subject, and for keeping him in fellowship as I could fellowship any man that could be suffered to live amongst us, and when we could not stand it any longer, to cut him off behind the ears according to the law of God in such cases. Hosea Stout's diary, 17 March 1848, has to do with a man named Isaac Hill who was, he felt, was slandering the brethren. I resolved to put a stop to his course. Things were taking at the risk of my life, and being highly inflamed or rather enraged at the mean course of Hill, I lit upon him, determined to stop or kill him. We had a short scuffle when I got him across the counter and had him choked, securely choked, until he could not breath, intending to hold on peaceably as I was but parted by John Lytle, which put an end to the matter now. After this flare-up was over, the police came together and we told Dalton and those who were concerned that we would put an end to their course or the end of their lives. After this, I never heard another murmur from any of them. Same date from Michael Quinn's Origins of Powers. He quotes from a high council meeting, quoting from him. Hosea Stout's statement to the Nauvoo, to the Salt Lake High Council. It has been my duty to hunt out the rotten spots in this kingdom. I have tried not to handle man's case until it was right. And I guess maybe a summary statement for the, which I think is pretty realistic, comes from John D. Lee's Remembrances. Whatever the police were ordered to do, they were to do and ask no questions. Whether it was right or wrong mattered not to them. They were responsible only to their leaders, and they were amenable only to God. Under Brigham Young, Hosea Stout was chief of police. They showed me where they buried a man in a lot near the Masonic Hall. They said they got him tight and were joking with him while some men were digging his grave. They asked him to go with them into a pit of corn, saying it was fully grown. They told him they had a jug of whiskey catched out there. They led him to his grave and told him to get down there and hand up the jug, and he should get the first drink. As he bent over to get down, Roswell Stevens had struck him with his police cane on the back of his head and dropped him. They then tightened the cord around his neck to shut off his wind, and when they had covered him up, they set the hill of corn back on his grave to cover up any tracks that might lead to his discovery. Another man they took in a boat about 2 o'clock at night for a ride. When they had him out in the channel of the river, the man who sat behind him struck him upon the head and stunned him. They then tied a rope around his neck and a stone to the end of the rope and sent him to the bottom of the Mississippi River. There was another man, his name I have forgotten, who was a great annoyance to the saints at Nauvoo. He generally brought a party with him when he came to the city and could threaten them with the law, but he always managed to get away safely. They, the saints, finally concluded to entrust his case to Howard Egan, a policeman who was thought to be pretty long-headed. He took a party of chosen men or destroying angels and went to La Harpe, a town near the residence of this man, watched an opportunity when he would pass along. They saved him and buried him in a washout. In a short time afterward, a thunderstorm washed the earth away from his exposed remains. There are many, many accounts of violence in Nauvoo, everything from whittling a person out of Nauvoo to smearing them with outhouse waste to worse, Aunt Peggy riding on a rail and other indecencies.
There are two related questions. And many of, or both of these questions are often raised by those who take a different view than many of us on this panel do. One of the questions is, how representative of an entire culture is the violence which occurs in that culture? And the other question is, to what extent are leaders of a religious culture responsible for the violence that occurs against religious dissenters or against opponents? Let me give you a hypothetical. Say in the Republic of Ireland, which is overwhelmingly Catholic, a Roman Catholic cardinal gave a sermon in which he rehearsed the sufferings of Irish Catholics at the hands of Protestants for hundreds of years, and then said it was the religious right of the Catholics to take vengeance on their enemies and slit the throats of Protestants if they felt that they were turning against them. And then, if there were incidents in which Protestants were found with their throat slit, I'll step back a bit. If this is published by the Catholic diocese, where the Catholic cardinal has given this talk and therefore becomes part of the permanent record, which all Catholics in the Republic of Ireland could read. And then at some point, whether it's days or months or after this sermon, if they find on the streets of Dublin or wherever in the Republic of Ireland, Protestants with their throats slit, how many Mormon defenders of the faith would regard it as quote unquote mere coincidence that these Protestants had been killed in this manner? And how many of us as outsiders from this culture would say that the Catholic cardinal involved had no moral responsibility for what had happened following his sermon and its publication? Well, the culture of violence, as I see it, in Pioneer, Utah, has its roots with Joseph Smith. This is not something that is the creation of Brigham Young. It has its roots in Missouri, in a sermon which Joseph Smith himself published, often called Rigdon's Salt Sermon, but a sermon which threatened death against the dissenters, and then another sermon, which was the 4th of July sermon, which Joseph Smith definitely published. The first one he didn't. The second one was published, which threatened a war of extermination against the Missourians if they should come up against in any violent way or mean way against the Mormon people again. Well, the term extermination didn't originate with Governor Boggs, despite the kind of retelling that has become popular and common in Mormon culture. The word extermination was first used by Sidney Rigdon, and it was applied to Missourians. In 1843, Joseph Smith told General Conference, quote, "I'll wring a thief's neck off if I cannot bring him to justice any other way." Joseph Smith had a publicly recognized and described pattern of slapping and punching people who insulted him from the mid-1830s until his death in 1844. Sidney Rigdon, an April 1844 conference, stated to the assembled thousands, quote, "There are men standing in your midst that you can't do anything with but cut their throat and bury them," unquote. Such sermons were commonplace in Pioneer, Utah, by Church President and Governor Brigham Young, by his counselors in the First Presidency. It's difficult for us in an environment which has encouraged peace, which has encouraged tolerance, which has encouraged moderation, to understand the kind of environment in which essentially the leaders of the LDS Church said to the membership at large, "You may fire when ready," and never gave any limits on when they should or could take these kinds of violent actions against a whole host of people, those who were considered mobbers, those who were considered apostates, those who were the adulterers. And so when these occurrences happen, and I'm not going to mention the Mountain Meadows Massacre, because that actually I don't think is the best example of what I'm describing. It's the most horrifying example, but it doesn't represent the kind of more common things that were occurring periodically throughout the culture. There were a number, according to the accounts of Mormons living in communities that were up against the hills where there were canyons and streams running in the spring, that in the 1850s, as the summer, or rather the winter snows melted and the spring runoff came, that it was not uncommon to find bodies rolling down the canyons. And in more precise detail that we do have, aside from these reminiscent accounts, we have the Parrish murders in 1857. Also in 1857, Brigham Young gave an after-the-fact approval for Bishop Warren S. Snow, who castrated the young man in his ward. In 1858, there was a discovery of the decapitated heads of two women, one of whom had definitely been recently seen consorting with Gentile soldiers. She left her Provo ward and family to do so. Many historians claim it was mere coincidence that First Presidency Counselor Heber C. Kimball had publicly preached that adulterers should be decapitated and that Mormons should, quote, wipe out of existence, unquote, any Mormon women who were immoral. It was simply a mere coincidence that decapitated heads of women showed up after such sermons. These acts of murder and other attempted murder or violence were not random, nor were they mere coincidence. I see them as direct results of LDS leaders giving unrestricted authorization to both local bishops and regular Mormons to attack and particularly to kill any Mormon for apostasy, for theft, for adultery, as well as those who were defined or regarded as mobbers. In no sermon that I have ever seen on the topic of blood atonement, which is the generic term, they didn't always use that term, like Joseph Smith said, I'll wring the neck off, he didn't use blood atonement. But in none of these sermons do I ever find a text saying, but consult your local authorities, have a trial, give due process to the suspected or the accused person. Contact headquarters of the church before you take such a drastic action. In scores, possibly hundreds, if you count the local minutes of meetings given where these same kind of remarks were given by bishops and stake presidents, they did not give those kinds of limits. And it created a very violent culture in which terrible things happened. And the Mountain Meadows Massacre is certainly the horrifying example. But in some sense, it has distracted us from the larger culture of violence that had existed long before 1857 and continued long after. As late as 1889, the LDS Church newspaper was praising Mormons who were attacking federal officials, also condemning federal courts for trying to judge murders that had been committed at an earlier time by bishops and local law enforcement officials who were Mormon. So the culture of violence is far broader in scope than the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and it extends back to statements made either with the authorization of Joseph Smith or by him directly.
Well, as Will introduced me, I come from a different background. I'm descended from Mormon apostates who were from Scotland originally by the name of McCausland. And I'm working on a biography of my great-great-uncle, who was the first one to convert in the family and the first one to apostatize. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I really knew nothing about this Mormon background in the family until about 15 years ago. My grandmother had written a little sketch of the story, and I came across it, and I became increasingly curious about what really had happened. Three questions have kept driving me, and one was, why did they convert? What were the factors in the background that led them to convert in the first place? And then what led to their disillusionment? And then what happened next? Was there a spiritual vacuum in their lives? Did they take up another religion? So it's been the human story that's interested me. Their disillusionment was a complex thing. It was not just one event that happened. It was a growth over time, and it had many elements to it. But there were two primary events that were probably the straw that broke the camel's back. One was they discovered, probably through Garland Hurt at the Spanish Fork Farm, that Mormons were involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And the second was the Parish Potter murders. They were living at that time in Spanish Fork, 6 miles away. And these were apostates. And at this point, the McCausland's were also apostates, although they were keeping pretty quiet about it. So I've been spending a lot of time trying to understand this violence on the Mormon frontier. I was going to say that I have no axe to grind here, that I'm really just interested in the human story, and one man in particular, his search for God. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, maybe that's not quite honest, that I have become passionate. But it's about the two things that have made me very passionate have been letting the evidence lead me where it will. And secondly, to listen to the common folk. There's been so much written about Mormon leaders, but very little about what the average foot soldier of the kingdom said and thought. So that's what I've been focusing on. I would like to read what happened when Peter McCausland and the family left. The next year, they went to California with an army escort. About 40 families left with an army escort. They had applied to Governor Cumming, who had then applied to General Johnston, who gave them an escort. It was the only time that happened, that it was pre-planned. The army did escort other apostate Mormons, but this was advertised in the newspapers, both the Deseret News and the Valley Tan. So this was the only time that it was really set up and people went right from Camp Floyd, and then all the way up. The last ones were picked up at the Bear River. So the next year, Peter McCausland wrote to a friend in Scotland that he had been the one responsible for converting in the first place. And this friend, who had named Robert Salmon, had not yet emigrated to Utah. And apparently Robert had written to him and asked why he had left the church. And so Peter answers, "The Mormons do entertain doctrines that when they are put in force are destructive of the rights of their fellow man. Do I know this? Yes, I do. What are they? When the celestial law is fully put in force, there shall no one leave the Mormon church and go over to the enemy. The enemy here alluded to is the world, or all who do not believe in Mormonism. All who are not for us are against us, and of course enemies. How do they mean to accomplish this? The angel of the Lord shall destroy them, or in other words, the Danites shall slay them. The Danites are a well-disciplined branch of the priesthood, organized to execute a very prominent part of God's judgments upon the earth. Those who renounce the faith and who have courage enough to speak what he does think and know would meet with such a fate faster than a murderer or an adulterer. Who did I hear preach these doctrines? John Young, head patriarch, and many other dignitaries of the church. In fact, I do not mean to write anything in this letter but what I know and can vouch for as being doctrines entertained by the Mormon Church in Salt Lake. I heard the bishop of the 19th Ward declare, he first lived in Salt Lake City in the 19th Ward and then moved to Spanish Fork. I heard the bishop of the 19th Ward declare that if celestial law was put in force, they, the people of the Lord, would be cutting one another's throats. And then in the same letter, he says, "We were also taught that our minds might be prepared for coming events, to beware of sympathy, as that feeling would destroy a great many in this church. How that to beware of sympathy? Because when the time comes and is at hand, you may see the dead bodies of your fathers, your brothers, or your nearest, dearest relatives and friends lying upon the streets. And if you should pass by, say not a word to anybody, neither ask the cause. Just conduct yourself as if nothing had happened. All is right. It was done by authority." There's a very similar quote that I came across that kind of surprised me by George A. Hicks, who was writing in 1874. Now, Peter McGoslin knew George A. Hicks in Spanish Fork. They were there at the same time. And Hicks wrote, "The Reformation swept over the country like a tornado. It was then for the first time I heard the doctrine of blood atonement. Leading men in the church would say that if you find your father or your mother, your sister or your brother dead by the wayside, say nothing about it, but pass on about your own business. Secret deaths began to be quite common. If we heard of a secret murder in San Pete or Cache Valley, we knew the work of the Lord was progressing." And then Hicks said 4 years later in 1878, when he was writing, he wrote, "It was during the Reformation that the liable doctrine known as blood atonement was first preached in Utah. John Young, that same one man that started the Reformation in Spanish Fork, said there were hypocrites in Zion and that they were not fit to live, and the time had come that their blood would have to be shed to save them. And he continued, if you should find your fathers or your mothers by the wayside with their throats cut, go on about your business and say nothing about it, for it would be all right. Zion must be purified." George A. Smith preached the same doctrine at Payson, but I did not hear him. A.K. Thurber, the first counselor of J.L. Butler, who was bishop in Spanish Fork, often gave us a blood atonement sermon, and I have heard him. This preaching soon began to have an effect throughout the country, and many were the victims that fell by the hand of the destroyer. My wife and myself both saw the blood of the parishes at Springville 2 days after the murder. Those were truly perilous times, such as only fanatics know how to bring on a country. And then Peter also talks about the parish murders in the same letter to Robert Salmon. "Do I know of any," we're talking about blood atonement, "do I know of any such cases? Yes, I do. Not that I saw the deed committed with my own eyes, but this deed that I am going to relate was committed at the town of Springville, only 6 miles from Spanish Fork, where I resided at that time, and the people not being at all prepared to act by the council, pass by and not say a word about it, their secret deeds were published upon the housetops. So I got to know as much about it as if I had seen it with mine eyes. A day or so after it was done, a father and 2 sons had renounced the faith and decided on leaving the territory." And then he gives the same outline that Leo has just given us about what happened. And then he goes on, "I have not the least doubt but that you have heard of this case. Neither do I doubt but that it has had the appropriate coloring to suit the tastes of honest and faithful but too credulous saints at home in Scotland, put upon it by some faithful elder from Zion. But I have only to say I have given you a simple, unvarnished statement of the facts as they occurred, and would merely add that they were men of good moral character, had committed no crime, and were in debt to nobody. This act occurred during the Reformation excitement, and it was expected that the celestial laws were going to be put in force right straight, and as they had already declared their independence from the United States, they had full faith that the Lord would fight their battles and sustain them as an independent kingdom to the dismay and overthrow of all their enemies, even the prophet himself declaring that with 10 men of the right stripe, he could defy all the armies of the U.S., but the enemies from within were more to be feared, hence the necessity of cleansing the inside of the platter first." So then The other thing that I've come across in my research is because I was studying about how they left Utah and their escape and other people who were leaving. They left in 1859. There were lots of people who left Utah from especially 57, well, after the Reformation and when, especially when the army arrived here. And I found a number of quotes of people who left. Either the army met them or other people have met them, and the fear they express is quite incredible. And if we had more time, I would give you some of those quotes. But there's no doubt in my mind that, and then there are a few people like George A. Hicks who remained good Mormons and still talked about this violence. So I think that there, you know, the perception by the common person was that there was definitely violence on the Mormon frontier, and they feared for their lives if they had, especially if they had lost their faith. And I think finally, to go back to what the others have said, that, you know, people took Brigham Young literally, that he was the prophet. He spoke for God on earth. And to me, it's, you know, why wouldn't they believe him? They were the words from the prophet. And why wouldn't some believe that they were meant by God to carry out these statements of Brigham Young?
Personally, I think we've heard a remarkable set of insights on this problem. As we've discussed it, though, I've come up with some questions that I think might help us all understand it a bit better. And I'll throw these questions out in general to the panel. And my first question is, what would motivate this violence? What would be the cause of this level of violence? And I think that we would all agree that in Utah, these examples of violence tend to be highlighted and exaggerated, as any level of crime is, that most Mormons were decent, law-abiding people. But the leadership seems to be obsessed with vengeance, with the end of the world, with settling the scores for the sufferings of the saints. And what do you think would help us understand the mindset and the circumstances that would lead to a culture like this?
Yes. Well, I think one thing that was the belief that the millennium was coming, right. That there's some quite incredible statements by Brigham Young to the saints in Great Britain about gathering. And one of them, this was in 1854, the judgments of God will be fearful enough, for they will be poured out with fury, and in a day of vengeance which he has long kept in his heart. For he has a long time refrained himself while injured innocence has been crying with tears of blood for to be avenged. But in these latter days he will make inquisition, and woe to those who incur his just displeasure, for he will not spare. And then the next year he said, flee therefore from the sinks of iniquity and corruption, lest the fiery indignation of the Lord also consume you with the wicked, of whom he has decreed that he will empty the earth. So this whole atmosphere that the judgment of God was coming, and it was coming soon, and first you better gather to Zion to be spared, but if some of these evil people came through Utah on the way, then that was part of our job to take care of them.
Leo.
If we don't know how bad Missouri was, I don't think we can really understand this. If you don't know how much an apostate was hated, someone who turns on their brothers and sisters and inflicts the worst kind of suffering on them, I think you could make a case in the Mormon Reformation that some of the church leaders perceived that things were getting a little too slack and too comfortable. And maybe the level of dedication wasn't very strong, and there were some backsliders who were too well accepted. There was a crusade mounted to clean up from the inside. And I believe those insiders who were really losing their faith were more hated than the outsiders who may have been wandering through either as federal officials or immigrants.
Just let me add to millennialism, the Book of Mormon teachings that the Gentiles are going to reject the gospel. The Book of Commandments, the fourth chapter, 18:29, before the church is organized, said that this nation is as evil as Sodom and Gomorrah. And this was taken out when it went to the 35. 3 Nephi 16:10-12, which spells out the Gentiles, that if they do all these things, all these abominations, and have rejected my gospel, then I will take the gospel to the house of Israel. That was taught, and that was believed. Orson Pratt, until he died, hammered and said, 3 Nephi 16:10 has been fulfilled. The Gentiles have rejected the gospel. And add to that the pronouncements of Joseph Smith say that if the Gentiles do not, if the Congress does not provide us protection and redress, God will punish this nation and bring it down, and there will not even be a grease spot left.
One of the disturbing things about this situation reminds me of my reactions to the Balkan Wars. The people of Yugoslavia had lived in peace, a variety of ethnic groups, particularly in Bosnia, but throughout Yugoslavia for almost 50 years. And there had been killings during the World War II experience, where Croatians in particular had been massacring Serbs. But that had ended, and for 50 years, Croatians, Serbs, Muslims had lived in peace, and there had been many intermarriages, and the neighborhoods were integrated. There were many that were segregated, but many were integrated, particularly in Bosnia. And then Milosevic came to power and published as well as spoke about the heritage of persecution of the Serbs going back 500-600 years. It became a drumbeat, how we have been butchered, how we have been persecuted, how we have been attacked by the Muslims, by the Croats, but especially the Muslims. And the 50 years of peace, the loving relationships and between husbands and wives and relatives, the friendly relationships between neighbors that had lasted for 50 years, that's two generations, two full generations, evaporated. And I remember one account by a 9-year-old boy who walked out of his apartment building, and his neighbor pulled a gun and tried to kill him. The boy was a Muslim. We cannot underestimate what a drumbeat of incitement and appeals to a persecuted past, an incitement for revenge. We cannot underestimate that, what that can do. And contrary to what was said about, well, there are all these law-abiding good people, it's the law-abiding good people who killed one another in Serbia, who shot their neighbors, who shot 9-year-old kids. Not everyone who committed these acts in Pioneer, Utah was a Bill Hickman, who was a real monster in many ways. And I hope there are none of his descendants here, but he really was a real monster. Certainly he was a sociopath who felt no responsibility, moral responsibility or ethics for what he was doing. But that's not the typical pattern, I think. I mean, those men, I gave it as an example of an extreme case, but the Mountain Meadows Massacre is certainly a good example of this because it involves so many, and we know the life stories of those who were involved in the event. And these were not bloodthirsty. These were not vicious people. These men who committed these crimes, who not only killed the men next to them, but according to later disclosures, they also slit the throats of the women and children. The Indians didn't do that. These were men who loved their wives and children. These were men who were law-abiding and peaceful under most circumstances. But an environment of retribution had pushed them over the edge, as it did those, whoever it was who did the decapitations of those women, whether it was the husbands or someone else who felt that they had the right to do that, or the killing of the parishes or the castrations that occurred, and they occurred from Ogden in the north to Manti in the south that we have records of. These were not the William Bill Hickman type of people for the most part. These were good, law-abiding people who were gentle with their children, who were loving to their wives, who were good, just regular human beings like those in Bosnia and those elsewhere in Yugoslavia, or the former Yugoslavia. We just, I don't want to confront what human beings are capable of under these kinds of circumstances. And we cannot simply dismiss them as monsters. Unfortunately, that's not the case. That's not the pattern. People can do awful things and yet be wonderful people in other circumstances of their lives.
I think that touches on the how troubling these questions are and how difficult, especially as a historian, it is to have to deal with this, because you find yourself staring evil in the face. And human evil is a problem that has bedeviled the world's greatest philosophers to this very day. I remember receiving an issue of BYU Studies under Jack Welch recently that had a story plug title saying, "Problem of Evil Solved." And I just about threw the magazine out into the garbage. I did look at it. I don't know that the title was very representative. But I'm no fan of Bill Hickman, but I've wrestled with John D. Lee a lot lately. And what you find in dealing with these men is that in their terms, if you look at what they're doing, they believe that they are doing good. They are doing God's work, and they are immensely true and loyal to their personal beliefs. And I think you could definitely say this about Brigham Young. Brigham Young was fanatically devoted to the memory of Joseph Smith, and he was completely devoted to his mission of implementing the work of Joseph Smith. So this raises more complicated questions. How can people with very, what they would certainly see as high and noble motives, be led into conduct that's just troubling? But I'll step out of my own shoes and step into those of Eric Eliason, an English professor at BYU, who recently reviewed David Bigler's Forgotten Kingdom, which won the Best Book Award from Westerners International, and which I edited, so I'm very prejudiced towards the book. But Eliason essentially states the classic case, and I'd like to put this to the panel. Gentile travelers such as British explorer Richard Burton and U.S. Army surveyor Lieutenant John Gunnison, observed that murder and general lawlessness were rare in Utah compared to elsewhere in the West. Burton noted, "During my three-week residence in the Mormon city, not a single murder was, to the best of my belief, committed. The 3 days which I spent at Christian Carson City witnessed three. The presence of well-run courts and the low levels of violence were attributable to a large degree to the ideal of a just and covenant society that the Latter-day Saints were trying to build. The places in Deseret where lawlessness and murder occurred at higher rates tended to be those areas such as army camps and mining towns where Mormons' presence and influence were less pervasive." How would you evaluate that analysis of violence in Utah? How do you differentiate what was going on in Utah from the high level of vigilantism, which had often had great public support throughout the West?
Well, my take on that is that there was a different social dynamic operating from the beginning in Utah. From the beginning, it was a gender-balanced community, unlike virtually all of the West, aside from the Oregon settlements, were highly male-dominant, 90% male. And also, aside from the I don't want to get into the issue of is the male sex violent prone genetically, but I do want to point out that in the environments which were overwhelmingly male, 90% male, there also was a lack in these environments, almost without exception, with not including the Oregon settlements in Utah. In these other male-dominant, the institutions of civil law were not in place for years, and so that the law of the handgun was what settled disagreements, and that continued and became a pattern, and it became a tradition. So that even once law was established, and the institutions of government were established in these frontier settlements, and they became cities, there had been a tradition of violence as a resort, as the best way to settle disagreements. But in Utah, the rule of law was in place from the outset. It was a stable society. It was a society governed by law. It was a theocratic law, but nonetheless it was governed by law. And there was a gender balance, a family-dominant society, not a single male 18s to 30 society, which was the case throughout much of the West. So the dynamics of the society were different, and certainly that is something that immediately struck all outside observers, that the nature of the West in Utah was different from the West they could observe nearly everywhere else. And relatively speaking, there was a different nature of crime. Crime was different here, but the thing that distinguished Utah crime in many cases was that it was religiously motivated, which was not the case elsewhere through the West. There were not religious motivated crimes, and yet you can verify religiously motivated crimes in Utah, and that did set Utah apart.
Their magistrates, their juries, right from the beginning, as he said. And the other thing that he said earlier is that there is almost no punishment for people who have been fanatics in carrying out these punishments. There isn't any deterrent to that after the fact. There are a few scapegoats in the very end, but it's amazing how much all of these actions are condoned. Now, the question asked about the foreign observers, and there were many, many of them. I know of maybe 20 diaries fairly well, and very few of those could verify the specific acts that we've heard a little bit about. I can think of one involving a doctor named Flint herding sheep from Indiana to the Sacramento area. And when he went through the Cedar City area in 53, which is the Waukara wartime, at least a dozen families, mostly Scottish, took that opportunity for protection to go with them. And they wouldn't even go after their stray cattle at night. They would let them go rather than venture out of the safety of the campfires because they were afraid of retaliation. Now, as soon as they got further down the trail where they thought it was safe, they left and moved faster. There are not very many of these instances of violence that were revealed to outside observers. I'm convinced of that. There are very, very few that they could get any more than rumors of. Very few witnesses among the outside observers.
Horace Greeley does say in some of his letters to the East that he figured there were at least 75 murders that were reported to him. So he was one observer that at least heard the stories and gave them some credibility.
Well, this review appeared in the Farm's Review of Books, and I heard a very interesting session that pointed out that they're often not very good on facts, and I think that might be an explanation for some of it. But in a conversation with Michael Quinn, he pointed out to me that, and I think this is an important insight, the difference between vigilante violence in the general West and violence in Utah is the official sanctioning. It is government officials getting up and promoting what are essentially crimes for whatever justification. But I think that with the other elements that the panel discussed does make the quality of violence in Utah unique. Now, another question that I'd like to raise is, what about the level of proof? Can you prove that any of this violence was connected with Mormon leaders? The continuing argument here is that Brigham Young was simply using rhetoric. I don't recall a single contemporary reference that said, oh, he was just joking or he was just giving us some rhetorical examples. But Mormon defenders typically say this was just talk. This was just rhetoric. And another problem with dealing with these kinds of events is perhaps exemplified by the John D. Lee quote that Bill read. Lee's a convicted murderer. He's a multiple murderer. He's arguably a monster. He confesses to a whole range of crimes in his confessions. Is he reliable? Is he simply trying to transfer guilt to somebody else? A remarkable example of where this question came up was raised in an article that Davis Bitten wrote on one of my pioneer heroes, George A. Hicks. And it's seldom that you see a Utah pioneer kicked around in the pages of the Utah Historical Quarterly, but that's what Bitten does to George A. Hicks and his reputation. He calls him a whiner. He calls him a complainer. I think George A. Hicks was a hero because he stood up and asked Brigham Young in a letter directly, do you or do you not support the Mountain Meadows Massacre? Young never answered the question in his reply. One of our panelists, Polly Aird, shared my concerns about this Hicks article, which seemed inexplicable in its motivations. Although I noted that the Hicks material came out of the suppressed Romney collection that is locked up in Ron Esplin's office at BYU. And I had a request to mention that, so we're past that. But I sent them an email, and I said, does this mean, because you've cited it in the Romney collection, that I could come down and look at it? They did not give me the courtesy of an answer. And Ron Esplin has not only kept these documents, which is a complete record of the TypeScript record of what's in LDS archives, but he has gone up to USU and dragooned the Romney collection copies that were in the Leonard Arrington papers and extorted them out of the archives at Utah State University. my suspicion is that the motive of this article was to put a good spin on this very difficult, controversial correspondence between George A. Hicks and Brigham Young. Because what Brigham Young is telling George A. Hicks is shut up and mind your own business. But we get this very odd assault on a man of, I think, great integrity and courage from Davis Bitten. He calls him insolent and a nuisance. And I've wanted to ask Davis at some point, what would you call a German war resister? Disloyal? But this was the response that Polyaird sent to Davis, to the Historical Quarterly. Hicks may not have been an eyewitness to the instances of violence he attributes to the doctrine of blood atonement, but to write that doctrine off as something that, quote, was never carried out in practice, quote, suggests an unawareness of the research of scholars like D. Michael Quinn. In The Mormon Hierarchy, Extensions of Power, Quinn documents some 24 instances of murder or mutilation instigated or approved by Mormon leaders in the name of blood atonement, including the ones cited by Hicks. Davis's response is somewhat rambling, and I think he sort of stands on his reputation as a Mormon historian. But his basic response to that question is, we may have different standards of what constitutes compelling evidence. So how would you folks respond to the problems with the evidence that support the attribution of violence in Utah Territory to the leadership and the religion?
Before they do that, let me just address the Nauvoo issue. Brigham Young in 2 January 1846 addressed a larger group of priesthood holders in the Nauvoo Temple saying, "And we will go to a land when there is at last no old settlers to quarrel with us, where we can say that we have killed the snakes and made the roads, and we will leave this wicked nation to themselves, for they have rejected the gospel. And I hope and pray that the wicked will kill one another and save us the trouble of doing it." We don't know if that's rhetoric, but I think the proof is that Irving Hodge was murdered by the Nauvoo police within a rod or so of Brigham Young's door, talking with Levina, and she asked this very real question: would Hosea Stout have acted without permission?
There was a judge here in Utah, John Cradlebaugh, who the Mormons did not like. He tried in 2 years after the Parish Potter murders and after the Mountain Meadows Massacre to do an investigation. And he took affidavits of a number of people in Springville. There were 9 taken. Most of them, well, maybe not most of them, some of them definitely imply that Bishop Snow had orders from up high. And it just seems to me when you have 9 people giving some testimony that has come down to our day, that's fairly credible that it happened. On a number of other blood atonement murders, he also took some affidavits, but they were maybe 5 in one case, in the case of Henry Jones and his mother. And there were 2 in another, the case of Henry Forbes. So there were affidavits taken from people of the time that were taken admittedly 2 years after the crimes, but still, from our perspective, that's not too far away.
There is a pattern of defense that not just runs through Mormon culture, it runs through many different cultures and their histories. In seeking to free the admired leaders from responsibility for things that are done in their names or that are done that give them benefit in one way or another, And I don't know that there will ever be an answer or a resolution to that, because intelligent, academically trained historians are often involved in that process of seeking to relieve admired leaders in various countries and various time periods from the responsibility for things that are done that benefit them, or things that are done that they might not have given express orders for, but that certainly fulfill their intentions or their hopes. And I think that's just, you know, the nature of the enterprise of history, is that if you, as a historian, require a paper trail of evidence for every conclusion, then you can certainly limit the conclusions that you're going to be making. And so the problem is that historians apply that to things that they don't want to acknowledge, and things that they do want to acknowledge, they don't require as much of a paper trail. I like to try to avoid that problem by applying the standards of evidence even-handedly. And so in that respect, I will say that I know of no evidence that Brigham Young specifically ordered any of these killings that occurred. However, like the example I gave earlier concerning the hypothetical situation in the Republic of Ireland, I cannot see under any circumstances how not only a historian, but just any person on the street would be able to say that Brigham Young, in repeated sermons over a variety of years, which he authorized the publication of not only in the United States, but also in Great Britain, how he bore no responsibility for murders that were committed along the lines and with the authorization that he gave. So on the one hand, I acknowledge what Davis Bitten or others may say, that no, there is no evidence of Brigham Young's specific responsibility for ordering. But I think in terms of evidence for his specific responsibility in authorizing, there is numerous evidence of that.
I think we're going to have to go to questions, general questions. But I would like to point out that by Bitten's standards of evidence, I don't think he could prove that Al Capone ever killed anybody. But you've now heard our exalted opinions. I'd like to open it up to questions from the audience. Yes, this woman here. Absolutely.
No.
Absolutely. They were in danger. You can't be an apostate in Springville and be safe. The question is, we have a woman with an ancestor who left Utah in the middle of the night. The question is, would they really have been in danger? I think Leo answered that. Yes. Oh, the question is, would Polly Aird read some of the statements of people who were fearful in Utah Territory?
The first one was published in the Mountain Democrat, a newspaper in Placerville, California. Two men, said the article, had been hired to guard the overland mail between Genoa, which is in Carson Valley, Nevada, to Big Meadows in western Nevada, near the sink of the Humboldt. And on July 13, 1858, the men, quote, stated that they overtook a train consisting of 16 Mormon families hastening on to Carson Valley These families were, they said, in perpetual dread of being pursued and massacred by the Salt Lake Mormons, and were making almost superhuman efforts to widen the distance between themselves and the sanguinary saints. Then in 1860, there was an army contingent that was on the central route across Nevada, protecting immigrants from Indians. But he says, the Lieutenant Perkins says, "On my arrival at Deep Creek, I found awaiting me an emigrant party, Mormon apostates, so-called, of 186 men, women, and children. By means of Mormon threats, both before and after leaving Salt Lake Valley, they had been reduced to a state of abject fear." Referring to the same group, the assistant surgeon who was along on that escort wrote, "Before leaving, the apostates were threatened by both Brigham and their teachers with being overtaken.